Today our subject is Zen practice and daily life. Today your turn. Okay. Okay. I think it is better you sit here and I take this. Okay. Wherever I go to have a session, the most common question is how to apply Zen practice into our busy daily life. This is the most common question. But in my sense, I've never had such a sense to apply my Zen practice in my daily life. I've never had such a sense, such an idea. I just do what I have to do. Just I do. That is my just daily life. This is not the matter of skill or way or method. This is not the matter of how to apply Zen practice into our daily life. Not like this. This is a matter of understanding of one thing, one meeting, one matter we meet. This is a matter of understanding of this one thing we meet. This is what I found in myself. And I should confess my daily life. Mostly, of course, in the morning I sit in Zazen. And in the evening, twice a day. And mostly what do I? Some friends asked me, what are you doing in your hermitage? So I needed to inquire, what am I doing? And what I found is, can you imagine? Most of my daily hours, I have been things more than 20 years. I have been spending my daily life, doksan, in fact, doksan. What I found recently. Quite recently I found most of my day time I use for doksan. With God? No. With my friend's question. Sometimes facts from Japan, from European friends, from you, not only facts, sometimes telephone. But some of them very important, very important for myself. So their question is for me, my daily food, very some of them, very nutritious, Yes, for me, question is more important than the answer. Therefore, please try to feed me with your very important question. You have. Yeah. Especially now, Doko, for example. Doko, you are an Ayurvedic doctor. Yeah? So you sometimes come to me with very good medicine. And sometimes inject into my stone head. Very medicinal. Mm-hmm. So, I need such a new medicine. You too. Mm-hmm. So, because my answer, I have to answer. I cannot ignore. Important, very important question. So what I do is, but in English, I take time. Therefore, my daily life is mostly, I need to be in my cave, hermit cave, hermit club cave. Yeah. I need to be my club cave. Yeah. So, but that is my most enjoyable life, in fact. And some questions take a long time. Some of them, once I write a reply, and then I put and I sit in my cave. I sit. Not in Zendo, but in my, I sit. And again, this is not. So I need to try again. That is my core. Therefore, what I confess, what I am now writing since 20 years is, in fact, the selection of core ones. Koan means Koan is I need to explain anyway. My original awakening is and then suddenly become what I do, Mu universe. So what I say, universe. Very honest, very, as I do, universe, that is the universe, embodiment of the universe. This is what I found. So this is the first koan, but koan, many aspects, many if I awakened with this fact of universal embodiment, universal truth embodiment, that is only one universe. Koan, and Koan is many unknown, many universes, unknown. Through Koan, they come. We need some, basically, of course, one. But many aspects and nature and elements with all necessary points or subjects or elements or something very necessary, very important. They still we don't know. Universe is really unfathomable. Yeah. Can you measure? No, we can't. Even if we get enlightenment after background of enlightenment also, infinite enlightenment. Our practice, therefore, our practice and experience, infinite, endless. If you get one, that's all. But soon it's getting lost. Hadithah. So we need new experience. But this is unknown. Different kind. We don't know. Not same experience. So, universe is so abundant. For example, Nick, thank you very much. You are wonderful, compassionate universe. For example, you wrote Iraq reality. Such a universe. For example, really big koan. For example, when Bush attacked Iraq, what I felt is, what my Zen practice is so useless. What can I do? I could do nothing. What I felt. That is real koan for me, wonderful koan. Even if we get enlightened, this is different koan, isn't it? In a sense, we need many subject koan. Problem. So daily life. Daily life. Seamless. New discovery of question. Not only but outside, from outside. But outside is innermost. Outside is inside, really. For example, you are. For example, you are my internal being. This is the content. This all of you is content of my my sight view. Right? This is not outside. Inside. This is inside. Yeah? daily Zen practice. Of course, we do one thing at one time. This is a daily Zen practice. Whatever we do, chanting is chanting. And going for a walk, just going for a walk. That is Zen practice, really. But we seriously, we confront the unknown new poem, new problem, like what I said, when Bush attacked Iraq. That is just one tiny tip of example. But the unknown many. So concern, our subject, our eyesight is not this way, not this, but also open. All the reality as it is, as they are. Oh, this is necessary. The more we find the reality deeply, the more after I found my deep blindness. Therefore, I need your injection. Yeah, sometimes really medicinal for me. But when I am in my crab cave, that is my endless universe. Yeah. Very vast cave. With many koans, with many koans, many important ones. I cannot ignore. So some important koan is my really deeply ingrained in me. Some question. With very deep suffering, pain. So it takes time, some of them. After 1 year, new answer I have to reply. So therefore my room is so messy. With documents and some of them are very moldy. This is my daily life, in fact. And this is my really enjoyable life. Inevitable life. But sometimes my blindness is also deepening. My blindness is more expanding, I feel. So what am I doing really? With such a koan, I sit in Zazen in my cave. This is my daily Zen practice. I don't feel at all to apply my Zen practice into my daily life. That's the opposite. How to apply my daily life into Dharma, into Zen practice. Which is main, daily life or Dharma practice? equals. Okay. Therefore, sometimes I need reverse. But now I reverse and clearly I need good opportunity to reverse between students and teacher. I'm teacher? No. Student. I'm student of I got now 4 teachers, but not 4. Shooting plus more. But I need some daily handstand practice. Reverse. I need daily. So then you're pleased. Sorry? Okay. Last night. To help others, to help suffering. One fourth. Sorry? Fourth. One fourth, no? And yes, today I remember about your talk. When you found suffering is beginningless and endless. When you found such a reality, your personal physical pain, suffering pain, disappear. That is my miracle one. This is endless koan, unexhaustible koan. Thank you very much. thank you very much. No, koan donkey. I am old. Cow and donkey. A mule. Mule is bigger, no? Than donkey. But in my case, donkey. Yes, I have to be, but I'm so...
Good evening. And it was a beautiful evening. There was sunshine. There we are. Wasn't just the room lighting up. Before I get on to the main topic that has been assigned to me this evening, I feel I must go back, cover something from a couple of nights ago in defense of the scientific method. It got a bit of a bashing a couple of nights ago, and I really felt that was unfair because I thought the problem was more with the application of the method than the method itself. And I've always, the thing that prompted me to think this is I've always regarded Buddha as a scientist, admittedly with limited equipment, but didn't he make good use of what he had? A body, a brain in pretty good working order, and a big problem. And he set about trying to solve it. And he experimented. He went to different teachers, trying one method after another over a period of time. And none of them solved his big question. During that process, of course, he was developing some pretty remarkable powers of concentration and samadhi, one would assume, but he still didn't have the answer. And at his wit's end, he came up with, heaven forbid, a hypothesis called the middle way. He didn't know whether it worked, but he thought he'd give it a try. So, with respect, Hogen-san, not all hypotheses are bad. Because the middle way started life as a hypothesis. I think so. Buddha then went on to prove it. He then went on to prove that it worked. So his idea worked. Well, we think so. It seems to. So, just a little defense for the scientific method, because I think it has a lot to offer. And when you look at the way the Buddha analyzes things too, just the Four Noble Truths, it's like a medical book. You've got a disease, you've got a cause ascribed to it, you've got a suggested method of treatment, and you've got its application, the Four Noble Truths. You can apply that to almost any medical situation, and it works. I imagine it's like opening up a textbook. Some doctors here will tell me, yes or no. Yeah. So, I still think Buddha was a scientist, and possibly one of the most important ones. I think his discovery probably far will outlast E equals MC squared in terms of importance to humanity, I hope, but time will tell. So, on to the main topic, applying Zen practice in daily life. The third Chinese patriarch of Zen said, famous quote, "The great way is without difficulty. Just cease having preferences." The great way is without difficulty. Just cease having preferences. I should finish there. I really should finish there. I've got another 8 or so pages, but I should finish there. Because, okay, hands up anybody who's ceased having preferences. Leave the room. Honestly, couldn't we spend the next year, 2 years, 10 years working on that? Ceasing having preferences. And where do our preferences come up most? They come up a fair bit in doing Zazen, but it's more in everyday life that we get trapped by them more readily. In Zazen, we're kind of waiting there like that spider. And we're watching, like the cat at the mouse hole, watching for preferences to come up. And yet when we're out in the real world, in the flames all around us, in chaos and confusion and phones ringing and not wanting to be bothered and children needing to be fed and all that stuff, it's very difficult to keep that background awareness alive and not having preferences, or at least spotting preferences when they come up. Because we're assailed with preferences, and as if we don't make enough of our own, society keeps loading us up with more and more things we've got to prefer, more we've got to prefer. And filtering that out is a pretty heavy task. So should I stop there? Can we just go back and work on that? Probably should, but I'll go on nevertheless, because I've got my allotted time. And it's not dinner time yet. Oh, by the way, a new angle on the spider koan. During the past week, there's been a very diligent little spider there.
who has insisted, is it a huntsman?
No, this is tiny little, like a money spider, very tiny. And somehow it's decided that I'm part of its nesting routine. And I'm an anchor point. And I don't know how it does it, but a couple of times every day, it somehow manages to get webs attached to my head, including my eyebrows. I don't know how this happens. And then all of a sudden I feel this sort of little movement on my face at the back of my head or something, and I, out of the corner of my eye, see this little sucker climbing up the web, you know. This is true. It happened about four times. I don't know where he is now. And I sort of diligently remove him and put him over there, because I don't want the poor thing to... Nothing. It's not even a web yet. I'm very compassionate. Don't waste your thread on me. Go somewhere else, you know. But every day it's come back, and it's extremely diligent. I've yet to know how it gets up on my head, whether it flies or just casts the web in the air and it connects. I don't know. But it's very accurate. It's always sort of, well, two or three days in a row, it's both eyebrows as anchor points. So that was apropos of completely nothing. But the funny things that happen in Zen Buddhas, not many, but there are a few. So why do we have to worry about Zen in everyday life? And what's the problem? Surangama Sutra. I'm going to quote from a few sutras tonight. I like reading sutras. There are bits of them that are very, very useful to practice. There's a whole lot of them that don't mean anything to me, but some bits do mean something. From the Surangama Sutra. Because living beings from time without beginning have pursued forms and sounds, and have followed their thoughts as they turn and flow, they are still not aware that their nature is pure, wondrous, and everlasting. So good, I'm going to read it again. Because living beings from time without beginning have pursued forms and sounds, have followed their thoughts as they turn and flow, they are still not aware that their nature is pure, wondrous, and everlasting. I should stop there. That's good enough. But that's me. That's probably a lot of us. Now, turning to something more practical, although that's pretty practical when you think about it, just looking at that, pursuing forms and sounds, in other words, all these outside things, whether it be a new car or this or that or this gadget or, you know, right down to wanting to be enlightened, you know, the whole gamut of things, want, need, have, I, me, mine, over and over and over, endless tape, never stops. It's infuriating. I find myself getting infuriated during retreats because the tape just never damn well stops. It's usually when I get really infuriated that it does stop, it'll calm down a little bit. But I have to get really mad at it for that to happen. And then it sort of backs off a bit. It realizes it's being watched and might be in danger. But in everyday life, endless, you know. Endless power, just real, one after another, and there's sort of millions of tapes that play all at the same time, and one of them comes to the surface and another one comes to the surface. So yes, that's what it's all about, pursuing forms and sounds and following thoughts as they turn and flow. I'd describe it as being dragged around by thoughts as they turn and flow. Because of all that, we're not aware that our nature is pure, wondrous, and everlasting. And it is. And we're being denied that by this spam that we send ourselves. So, a bit of context and a bit of revision for the week. We can't let you go home without some revision. We've been talking about Kai, Jaw, Air, precepts, samadhi, and wisdom, the three indispensables you must have. What are they for? They're to stop suffering. Stop not only our suffering, but if we follow the Mahayana path, as Zen practitioners do, free the world from suffering, not just ourselves. If we cultivate precepts, samadhi, and wisdom sufficiently well and sufficiently diligently, This will lead us to a state where, as the sutras say, we have no outflows. Outflows are functions of the self that go out into the world and cause havoc. As Dzogchen and Genjo said, I certainly remember them saying it, it's like Master Dogen's poem, you let the world come into you when you're meditating. But what we try to do is send the ambassadors of ourselves out to the world to conquer it. So that's outflows. When we practice precept, samadhi, and wisdom well enough, the outflows will stop, or at least start to die down. And when they stop, you're finished. Isn't that wonderful? You've finished the hard study, then the endless practice, the natural practice, the kind of, I hope it's effortless, practice begins, never ending. But unless we're a fully enlightened and realized being, the precepts, the samadhi, the wisdom involves conscious effort, involves intentionality on our part. So it's not a natural thing. We have to keep working at it. This is the practice level that we are at, just about all of us, where we have to intentionally invoke the precepts, intentionally invoke samadhi, intentionally try to invoke a tiny bit of wisdom in what we do. But the good news is that when we practice hard enough and long enough or well enough, that the intentionality is not necessary anymore. Once we lose this attachment to self, and our suffering, our vexations, dukkha, is finished, then the practice becomes natural. The intentionality is not needed. But right now, intentionality is needed. And it's the skill of learning to invoke that intentionality in our daily life, which is what we're talking about here. So, thought I'd throw in an enlightenment definition. Nobody's defined enlightenment at this retreat, so I'll have a go. Freedom from vexations, suffering, dukkha, Four Noble Truths, and the realization of wisdom, prajna. Let's take that as a working definition of what we're trying to cultivate here. To get to that position, the cultivation of samadhi on its own is not enough. I think we've heard that already. We've got this wonderful diagram to demonstrate that. And our actions, our words, our thoughts are the field of practice for the precepts that are so necessary in order for us to experience and develop samadhi and prajna. Because without the precepts, without the proper practice of the precepts, whereby we learn to regulate our actions, our thoughts and our words, we'll never get to the type of samadhi that we want to achieve. And it's probably another definition. I like definitions. Samadhi. That's a term that's just used so much in Buddhism, and it means so many different things. The way I'll be using it tonight, two. One is, in the traditional sense, in the Yoga Sutras, not that I know much about Yoga Sutras, but I remember reading Patanjali when I was 15. And the samadhis, they're very scientific, I think. There's lots of categories. Is that the right book? Yeah, Patanjali? Yeah. All these categories of different samadhis and absorptions, and where to my memory of being 15, it seems as though you eventually sort of disappear into nowhere. And you have no contact with the world in some of these samadhis. And I'm sure that's achievable. But that is not the samadhi of Zen practice. The samadhi of Zen practice is being fully aware of where you are, what you're doing, and everything else that's going on around you. But it's doing it in a way where you're very clear about things and you're not pulled around by your emotions, by forms, by circumstances. It's an active form of samadhi, as opposed to the deep inward samadhi that's not in touch with the outside world. Zen is very much about being in touch with the outside world. So, the practice of precepts is what I'm saying, important to the actual cultivation of samadhi. And without the successful practice of precepts, wisdom won't arise. The prajna that we're hoping to bring to being won't arise. It's a package deal. Precepts, samadhi, prajna, or wisdom. They all go together. You can pick and choose, but the result will be incomplete. I think Hogan-san used the word crippled. In other words, you only get part of the solution. You certainly won't get liberation from suffering. When wisdom manifests and your suffering disappears, you actually no longer want to commit acts that cause suffering to you and others. But that manifestation of wisdom doesn't necessarily coincide with the first insight into self-nature. You know, we hear countless stories about awakening experiences in Kensho and experiences seeing the true self. But often that's just a tiny glimpse. I'm reminded, because I'm old enough, to remember when mankind didn't know what the other side of the moon looked like. A total mystery. And then in 1959, the Russians sent up a little thing. No. Thank you. And it took a picture. Go to the top of the cloud. It took a picture and sent back the picture. And I remember seeing the picture as a very young person on the front of the newspaper. And you couldn't tell a damn thing. It was a shocking picture. It had some white blotches and some black blotches, and that was about it. It was useless. It didn't stop the Russians naming the black blotches after famous Russian scientists or politicians. And of course, the Americans were mortified. But from that first glimpse, a lot was learned. There is another side to the moon. And heaven, you know, how amazing. It looks just like the other side. But we didn't know that. It was just simply a territory that mankind knew nothing about, rather like what we're sitting here trying to discover in a physical analogy. And so time passed, and that was the only photo. And then the space race got underway, and then people wanted to know more about the moon, and more probes were sent, more and more photographs were taken. Eventually humans, somebody is going to say this is a conspiracy theory, I actually believe it happened. People went to the moon and orbited around the moon and took lots of pictures of the far side of the moon. So what you have is progressive awakening experiences about man's understanding of the far side of the moon. It's just a trite analogy, but it serves the function. First glimpse, incredible, you know, front headline news. The world has never seen the other side of the moon before. Big deal. But we actually learned very little. But the real knowledge came later, as the boring stuff happened, as the hard work began of actually documenting piece by piece by piece. It's rather like the unfolding of enlightenment. You have the initial Kensho experience or something like that, and an awakening. Big shock. Wow, there's a whole other universe here. I didn't know it was here all along, and it's here, and it's dancing in front of me. Incredible. It's alive. It's compassionate. It's everything. They said it was. But, oh, where did it go? It disappeared. Can I get it back? No. Wait for the next installment. And so you sort of fret over when the next installment's going to come, and a lot of time passes. And so the experience is like that. It's little pieces that come together, sometimes really big pieces. Master Hakuin documented that he had 18 great awakenings and countless lesser ones. That's a CV if ever I heard one. He gets the job. How did I get onto that digression? I'm talking about the fact that the simple act of seeing self-nature does not mean the end of suffering. It means the beginning of real Zen practice. The end of suffering comes when you've totally become familiar with the landscape of enlightened awareness. And the self has been completely seen through for what it is. And at that point, the precepts, I'm told, become natural and non-intentional. But up to that point, the practice of the precepts is a hard slog of every day, every encounter, every moment, bringing that intentionality to the situation as you get more and more fluent with applying them. What errors that you learn from your errors. You just get better and better and better as you go along gradually. Sometimes big setbacks, but you know the story. Unusual. Story about the poor guy that makes good. The rocky story. There'll always be setbacks. But keep trying. Okay, so that's the precepts. That's my take on the day-to-day aspects of the precepts. I'll come back to it a little bit. Samadhi is the second thing. As I mentioned the other night, samadhi is the I see shikantaza as the simultaneous practice of stillness and insight. In other words, stopping or calming the mind so that you can see. Because you can't see things clearly if the mind is going nuts, as it is most of the time. You just cannot simply, you can't even look at that and see that. You know, without the thoughts intervening, without all the concepts intervening, all the stuff we've been talking about. So I see shikantaza as a simultaneous practice of two things. Not exactly at the same moment, but more or less going in parallel, or one after another sometimes. Need a diagram. Am I allowed to do diagrams? Because it's occurred to me that a couple of things happening, or at least with me, during shikantaza. We've got this curse of thinking over on this axis. I don't have to explain that, do I? Discursive thinking, we're pretty familiar with that. And then over here we have clarity of awareness. Now I should have done these different colors. Okay, so discursive thinking is in black. Okay, so there's discursive thinking disappearing. Isn't that great? Wouldn't you wish it was like that? And it took about 3 minutes. And over on this axis, we've got clarity of awareness. And there seems to be this sort of relationship. As the thinking dies down, the awareness, the ability to be aware comes up. But it's not necessarily that simple, because there's another factor. I don't know if I'm allowed a formula, but I'm going to do a formula. Sorry, doctor, I don't want to walk in all your stuff here. Okay, formula goes something like this. Seeing, and I'm talking about clear seeing. Now, this is more important than MC squared. You saw my joke. Is SCP, the mystery ingredient, multiplied by 1 minus dt. Now, the I'm serious. dt is discursive thinking. Okay? So seeing is inversely proportional to discursive thinking, or has this complementary relationship as discursive thinking goes down. Clarity of awareness can go up, but you need this factor. Because if this is zero, you don't have any seeing. you can actually get rid of all your thinking and have no seeing. And that's your black hole. The mystery ingredient. I will. I wanted somebody to ask. Thank you, Josh. Because you understand the point I'm making here. I know not everybody does that. And I can't blame you. I don't do much myself. But SCP, if SCP is zero, then even if discursive thinking is zero, you've got a one here, you still haven't got any seeing because you've got zero times one. Okay? SCP is samadhi concentration power. Because if you can't concentrate well enough, you can get rid of all your thinking. And down here, you know, they'll put a sheet over you and put you in the ground because there's nothing going on. You're not seeing anything. Right? So this is the black hole you don't want to get to. You want to get up here. So not only do you need to stop your thoughts, because a lot of meditation practices in the past have involved stopping thoughts and nothing more, as if that's an end in itself. And what the Zen teachers say is, no, that's not an end in itself. It's power. Power. Kyoriki. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so that's the math lesson over for the evening. Is that any debate on this? Come on, throw something. Probably a book. Yes, there. I was going to put an X factor in there. But from the big picture, we can work on this. There could be a Nobel Prize in this. Yes. 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 Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, I didn't invent the formula. I mean, it's just putting into mathematical form what people have been saying for thousands of years. The zero. It could be an exponential function. I agree. And it could tend towards zero but never reach it, I agree, because maybe when you get zero thinking you're dead, I don't know. Is that right? Yes. Well, going to a very small level, where there are no thoughts. Well, it depends on what you're concentrating on. Well, the point I'm making is you can't concentrate on whatever the object of your meditation is, whether it's a breath function or the body or a sound, if the brain's chattering away. The discursive thinking is the chatter and the analysis and the objectification and the categorization, the span. Yes, but to get to it, you need to get to there, you need to concentrate on something. I think so. You've got to start. When you're starting from nothing, when you're starting from a state of just complete discursive thinking, what do? We bring our attention to the breath, or we bring our attention to the body. Or, if you're really good, bring your intention. Sorry? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. Can you build a practice on that? Can you build a practice on it? Yeah. You can get a falling off a cliff. You can get a having your leg broken. None of those methods are recommended. There are cases of people being enlightened having their legs slammed on the door. You know, they have to be ready, but you see what I mean? I'm talking about a comeback of the scientific method. It has to be repeatable. we're being scientific about this. In other words, what we're doing here is trying to repeat a method that has worked for other people. Right? It's ugly because a lot of people don't like to hear it that way expressed, but we are doing something. There is a process. We get to a point where we can let go of the method. I'm talking about getting into the stream to get to the point where you can let go of the method, where you can just take everything in, or rather, let everything in. Because there's no way, you know, you've got this pressure field around you of thoughts and concepts and things which are pushing everything out. You've just got to reduce the pressure field. And they'll come in naturally. They're there all the time. We can work on it. You could. None of these words is going to be accurate. They're just terms of art that have a meaning in some cultures or contexts. Well, it is, but sometimes to start the process, you start on something small. Like it becomes very constrained. Like just the breath or the nose. Then maybe the breathing or the counting. Or counting is very focused. I mean, it can be very expansive, but you've got to start somewhere. But yeah, I'm not hung up on the word concentration. I'd like to use the word jawriki because that's a well-established term. Samadhi power. Let's take concentration out. Samadhi power. Okay. Okay, I've spoken about samadhi and the sort of the different types of samadhi. I'll just make the point again that samadhi in its fullest cultivation in a liberated being, a Buddha, is 24/7. It's not something that has intentionality behind it. It's automatic. It's there all the time. There are no vexations. There's no experience the way we do of emotions to get in the way of seeing things clearly. Anger, excitement, all those emotions aren't experienced the same way. To Bodhisattva on the Mahayana path, the one thing is helping other beings. That's the mission objective. So there's no other attachment. There's no attachment. So this samadhi that's referred to in the Zen writings is quite different from the samadhi that's referred to in a lot of yoga writings. In that it is an active process. It's a process of being fully aware moment to moment to moment to moment to moment of what's going on and not being captured by it. And in fact it blends with prajna wisdom because if you look at the commentaries on prajna in the Altar Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, he uses the term prajna samadhi. And I'll come to that shortly. Just to finish off on Shikantaza, I'll read Chinese Zen Master Hongzhu Zhengshui, who wrote a book called Cultivating the Empty Field. His description of the silent illumination, which is also called Shikantaza. I have trouble seeing the difference between the two. There are those who say there is a difference, but I haven't found it yet. Depends on the teacher who's teaching you Shikantaza and the teacher who's teaching you silent illumination, I think. Silent and still, abiding in itself, just like this, in suchness. It is apart from conditioning, where luminosity is vast and spacious, without any emotional dust. Directly, the self is thoroughly relinquished. Arriving at this fundamental place, one realizes that it is not something newly acquired today. And to check myself, this coming home experience. You experience this and then you realize you have this feeling you didn't have before, or the natural home. From the ancient home before the great kalpa, there has been utter clarity without any obscurations, in its liveliness and readiness it shines alone. Though it is like this, without enacting it, there is no attainment. Precisely at the time of enacting it, simply keep it so that not a single thing arises. Do not allow a speck of dust to cover it. This is the great rest where one's vexations are dried up and frozen. There's vast and thorough, penetrating understanding. If this rest cannot thoroughly exhaust the self, if you wish to reach the realm beyond birth and death, there can be no such realm. Just directly penetrate through. You will then resolve this matter thoroughly without the dust of conceptual thinking and be purified without conditioned speculations. Take a backward step and open your grasping hands. Thoroughly resolve this matter. Then your ability to put forth light and respond to the world will be appropriate, merging with myriad objects just right on all occasions. Wide and far-reaching without limit, pure and clean, it emits light. Its spiritual potency is unobscured. Although it is bright, there are no objects of illumination. It can be said to be empty, yet this emptiness is full of luminosity. It illumines in self-purity beyond the working of causes and conditions, apart from subject and object. Its wondrousness and subtleties are ever-present. Its luminosity is also vast and open. Moreover, this is not something that can be conceived of as existence or non-existence, nor can it be deliberated about with words and analogies. Right here, at this pivotal axle, opening the swinging gate and clearing the way, it is able to respond effortlessly to circumstances. The great function is free from hindrances. At all places, turning and turning about, it does not follow conditions, nor can it be trapped in models. Pretty powerful description of silent illumination, Shikantaza. And it begins when it talks about being able to respond effortlessly to circumstances, and the great function is free from hindrances. It's now moving into the third point of the discussion, which is prajna. Now my trite definition of prajna, I made this up myself, so, walking down here the other day. The ability to know exactly what to do in any situation without thinking. That's kind of what Master Hongzhou is saying, I think. And in the sense of Zen practice, I think that's what it does mean. In other words, the natural response to circumstances that doesn't involve egotistical thinking, no self-cherishing, no self at all, just the good of the all. No attachment to the situation. Or of adapting to the natural thing to do, the natural response, the non-ego response to the situation. That's a very lofty concept. There of course is worldly prajna as well. I had a friend who died in the late 80s, early 90s, can't remember. He was a person who told me about this technique he had of the power of a superconscious mind. And he was an investor. He bought and sold shares. That was his life. He bought and sold shares. He lived very austerely. two pairs of trousers and three shirts. He had a black Bakelite phone, and he never made outgoing calls because he didn't like paying phone bills. When he died, he was worth $100 million. He never went on trips. He never drank. Never womanized. He just enjoyed playing the stock market. Because it gave an outlet to this power of the superconscious mind. And he said what he would do is that he would look at a prospectus or a set of financial accounts for a company. He'd work them over and over and over for a few days until he could, you know, he could recite them. Then he put it all away. A week or two later, out of all the companies he'd been going through, he'd decide which one. He wouldn't decide. He would know which one to buy. It was just like that. He didn't know where it came from. Now, he learned this from his boss in an accounting firm. And his boss called it the power of the superconscious mind. It sounds awfully like kind of pudgy to me. In other words, it's like a koan. You know, it's a stock exchange koan. You've got this mass of indecipherable data and all these conflicting things the thing was, he was right. He had $100 million to prove that he was right. This is the guy that started collecting bottles when he was 15. He had no shoes at 15. He built this up from scratch, just him, no one else. Just being an investor. He did indeed. He set up the chair of ophthalmology at the University of Queensland and gave that was about $40 million and gave the rest to other charities. He said, why don't you give some money to your sister? He said, oh, I don't want to do that. Just bugger up their pension. True story. Completely unattached to anything. And an amazing person. Never heard of Zen, never heard of any of this stuff. In a way, he practiced it in his own funny way. But what I'm pointing to, is there is this process whereby inspiration, grace, whatever you want to call it, sort of comes from somewhere that we don't understand, and we attribute it to various things. And Prajna, I understand, is rather like that. Okay, here's my speculation out of the way. I'll read a bit from... how are we going? Oh. We have to stop. Just getting going. I'll be quick. This is from Master Huineng. I'm sorry, I don't remember his name in Japanese. Eno? Huineng, yes. Eno, yes. The sixth patriarch. Good friends, this Dharma teaching of mine produces 84,000 kinds of wisdom from one kind of prajna. And how so? Because people have 84,000 passions. If they didn't have any passions, prajna would be ever-present and inseparable from their nature. Those who realize this teaching do so through no thought, no memory, and no attachment. Don't create a bunch of delusions. You yourself are the nature of suchness. View all things with wisdom, neither grasp nor reject them. This is the way to see your nature and become a Buddha. Okay. So, I was kind of hinting at it before, and I've gone on here, I'll deal with this quickly. There are two types of prajna, really. There's prajna in the Buddhist texts. There's prajna with outflows, in other words, prajna that occurs or that is practiced when you still have an attachment to the self that goes out to make a mess of the world. And there's prajna without outflows, which is when you finally transcend your attachment to the self, you have a prajna that functions effortlessly. You no longer have vexations, and you no longer create suffering for yourself or others. I venture to suspect that most of us are in the prajna with outflows category. In other words, we haven't completely cast off our attachment to self. And I'll just read you a short commentary about that. A person in whom such wisdom has arisen does not have genuine wisdom that relies on the Buddha's wisdom. Such a person keeps the precepts that he recited each night. studies the Dharma and practices samadhi. Having wisdom without flows is like trying to inflate a balloon with a slow leak. It needs constant attention to stay full. If you leave it alone, it will deflate. If you perform virtuous actions with a self-centered mentality, then you will create suffering. The good karma you reap will eventually diminish. Okay, that's kind of where I feel I'm at. The balloon with a slow leak. Kind of, what's the point here? Daily practice. Daily practice. Daily practice. If you let it go 2 days, in my case, a little bit grumpy. Even 1 day, it's grumpy. 3 days, panic. 4 days, don't want to be in the same room as anybody else. You know, it is addictive. You are peddling a drug. Zazen is addictive. Addictive, yeah. You miss it. You miss it. It's like an exercise junkie that stops going to the gym. You miss it. Yes. Yes. But I like the analogy of the balloon with a slow leak. The prajna that we use is someone else's borrowed prajna. It's the Buddha's prajna. We're borrowing it, and we kind of keep the balloon with enough pressure to keep applying the precepts in this intentional way. And if we don't carry out the precepts, practice samadhi, then the prajna, the ability to enact this prajna that we've borrowed for a time will decrease. So that's prajna, but there's another quote from Huineng England I couldn't resist. I'm going to go on all night. Shall I stop?
He's hungry.
Hey? Okay, this is good food. Good food, because it's not my words, this is Master Huineng's words. You can never hear enough of this. Good friends, this Dharma teaching of mine is based on meditation and wisdom. In other words, samadhi and prajna. You've heard all this before. Don't make the mistake of thinking that meditation and wisdom are separate. Meditation and wisdom are of one essence and not two. So this is an answer to the rhetorical question that I should have asked you a moment ago when I was looking down the page. Which comes first, prajna or samadhi? Which one? He's answering it now. One essence, not two. Meditation is the body of wisdom, and wisdom is the function of meditation. I'll say that again. I've got a big underline. Meditation is the body of wisdom. Wisdom is the function of meditation. Wherever you find wisdom, you find meditation. And wherever you find meditation, you find wisdom. Good friends, what this means is that meditation and wisdom are the same. Fellow students of the way, be careful. Don't think that meditation comes first and then gives rise to wisdom, or that wisdom comes first and then gives rise to meditation, or that meditation and wisdom are separate. To those who hold such views, the Dharma is dualistic. If the mouth speaks of goodness, but the mind doesn't think of goodness, meditation and wisdom aren't the same. But if goodness pervades both the mouth and the mind, if what is external and internal are alike, then meditation and wisdom are the same. Master Huineng called his practice one practice samadhi. One practice samadhi means at all times, here comes the daily exercise. Whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, always practicing with a straightforward mind. Okay, repeat. Important. One practice samadhi means at all times, 24/7, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, always practicing with a straightforward mind. The Vimalakirti Sutra says, a straightforward mind is the place of enlightenment, and a straightforward mind is a pure land. Don't practice hypocrisy with your mind while you talk about being straightforward with your mouth. If you speak about one practice samadhi with your mouth, but you don't practice with a straightforward mind, you're no disciple of the Buddha. Simply practice with a straightforward mind, and don't become attached to any things. This is what is meant by one practice samadhi. Deluded people who cling to the external attributes of dharma, of a thing, a dharma, a thing, get hold of one practice samadhi and say that it is sitting motionless, eliminating delusions and not thinking thoughts. And they say that that's one practice samadhi. But if that were true, a dharma like that would be the same as lifelessness and would constitute an obstruction to the way instead.
That's the dharma. If you get rid of your thinking,
it's not enough. The way has to flow freely. Why block it up? The way flows freely when the mind doesn't dwell on any dharma, anything. Once it dwells on something, it becomes bound. If sitting motionless were right, Vimalakirti wouldn't have criticized Shariputra for meditating in the forest. That's in the Vimalakirti Sutta. Which is very funny, because you've got this layman who gets around making a fool of all the bodhisattvas, with the Buddha's consent.
Yes, he's totally incapacitated and he's still telling the bodhisattvas what to do and how to do it.
Good friends, I know there are people who tell others to devote themselves to sitting and contemplating their minds or purity and not to move or to think. Deluded people are unaware, so they turn things upside down with their attachments. There are hundreds of such people who teach the way like this, but they are, you should know, greatly mistaken. Good friends, what are meditation and wisdom like? They're like a lamp and its light. When there's a lamp, there's light. When there's no lamp, there's no light. The lamp is the light's body, and the light is the lamp's function. They have two names, but not two bodies. This teaching concerning meditation and wisdom is also like this. End of prajna. And I hope you got the message there about at all times, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, always practicing the straightforward mind. There's nothing terribly cosmic about that. There's no blinding flashes about that. It's actually more important than the blinding flashes. It's moment to moment to moment, being here, unfiltered. That's the practice. I thought I'd give you a little bit on metta. Although you've had a lot of metta this week, but I'll give you a little bit more. This comes from Tore Zenji's Bodhisattva Vow. Tore Zenji is a Rinzai master from about the 1700s. This is part of a longer poem that he wrote, but it concerns on giving kindness, sympathy, and compassion. When I regard the true nature of the many things, I find them all to be sacred forms of the Tathagata's never-failing essence. Each particle of matter, each moment, is no other than the Tathagata's inexpressible radiance. With this realization, our virtuous ancestors gave tender care to beasts and birds with compassionate minds and hearts. I thought that was very good. That's on giving compassion. Then on receiving compassion, surprisingly, there's an art for that as well. And this is very relevant to our daily lives. Sure, there's somebody in everybody's life that this applies to. Among us, in our own daily lives, who is not reverently grateful for the protections of life? Food, drink, and clothing. I didn't want to remind you about food and drink, but come to that. You'll be over there soon. Though they are incarnate things, they are nonetheless the warm flesh and blood, the merciful incarnations of Buddha. So, sentient beings, in my mind, don't just stop at what we think of sentient beings. I remember when I visited Hogen Sun's master's monastery at Bukokaji, and there's so much bowing. After 2 weeks, I did a photocopy and bowed to the photocopier. I didn't intend to do it. It just happened. I was very respectful. Yes. It was hard to get to that photocopy. You have to fill in a lot of forms. I digress. We're talking about everything being the warm flesh and blood, the merciful incarnation of the Buddha. All the more, here comes the important bit, we can be especially sympathetic and affectionate with foolish people. particularly with someone who becomes a sworn enemy and persecutes us with abusive language. That very abuse conveys the Buddha's boundless loving kindness. It is a compassionate device to liberate us entirely from the mean-spirited delusions we have built up with our wrongful conduct from the beginningless past. With our open response to such abuse, we completely relinquish ourselves, and the most profound and pure faith arises.
Shall I read that bit again?
I think it's great. It's so hard. I've never done this yet. It's an aspiration. To actually completely relinquish yourself when someone's abusing you, and to treat it as a compassionate device. I know it, but it's so hard to put into practice. So, you know, when you're back at work on Monday or whatever it is, and somebody's hounding you, this is a bit tremendous. That very abuse conveys the Buddha's boundless loving-kindness. It's a compassionate device to liberate us entirely from the mean-spirited delusions we have built up with our wrongful conduct from the beginningless past. With our open response to such abuse, we completely relinquish ourselves, and the most profound and pure faith arises. So rather than, in that situation, extending compassion to the idiot that's abusing you, you're saying, thank you for being so compassionate to me. And the koan in this for me, I would take away from this, is with our open response to such abuse. Well, how do we respond openly to such abuse? It's going to be different in each situation. That's the skill it's going to take to find the right response in each situation where someone's giving you a hard time. Okay. There's more, but I'm going to be very brief. I'm now going to cheat entirely by repeating the... oh, please. Yep. Oh, yeah. No, it illustrates the point perfectly. I mean, it's not just about somebody bawling you out about using too many staples. This can be some pretty serious stuff here. I once had a boss who counted staples. It wasn't the Nune. Okay, now some rules on what to do in daily life when we leave this retreat, which we shall do tomorrow. Tomorrow being Master Dorgan's birthday. 808, I work out, years since he was born. Now, the first great master set of rules I will read, Master Hōgen Yamahata, has taken down in 2004 in this room. Master Hōgen's rules. 1. Zazen. As you might expect. When you get up, just sit unconditionally. Whatever you may have to do during that day. The quality of the sitting is more important than the length of the time you sit. Rule 1. Rule 2. Reading. Read slowly Master Dorgan's Hukan Zazen within the sutras after your morning Zazen or in the evening. Try to observe a regular time. 3. Mindfulness. Ask yourself, what am I doing now? This is during the day. just discover and clarify this one thing, which is what you are doing now. And do each thing, one by one, mindfully, wholeheartedly. Four, be like a mirror. Sometimes when we become carried away by circumstances and events or lost in our thoughts, it is necessary to stop whatever we're doing. And at this moment, be like a mirror to reflect our usual absent-minded stream of behavior. If things are messy, for example, just recognize the messiness. Five, last one. Resolve all points of practice. Whenever you have questions or unclear points regarding your actual practice, don't let them remain unclear. Pursue them until you clarify them. So there's one set of rules. Now, another set of, not so much rules. Those weren't rules really, they're practice advice. Practice advice. Day-to-day practice advice. Now, practice advice from Master Sheng Yin, a basic attitude towards everyday life. Don't regret the past. Don't worry about the future. Don't dream about the future, but plan for it and adhere to the plan. Revise the plan if necessary. Don't change the plan before starting it or change it too often. But don't regret the past, don't worry about the future. That's good insight. Two, maintain a serene mental state at all times in a relaxed physical condition. Empty your mind, be responsive to the present moment at all times. There's a thread emerging here, as you can see. Be clearly aware of what you are doing. Immerse yourself into the present. This means to concentrate, not be anxious. When the body and mind are relaxed and clear, responses are swift. Whatever you're doing, your mind should be right there. However, a precondition for the path to enlightenment is to have a clear understanding of emptiness, no self, no mind. Without this understanding, even with a calm and stable mind, one cannot become enlightened. Thus, a seated meditation practice is necessary. So far we've tick-tick. To realize no mind and no form, one must have a clear and continual awareness of minds and forms. Here are these forms again, these things. People are forms. The things we make of ourselves are forms. The idea of Peter, genuine, is a form. No such thing. No enduring quality whatsoever. Disappears every time I sit down over there. Got no lasting nature to it. I've lost my place. Merely conceptual knowledge of emptiness, no self and no mind, is of limited use. It is only knowledge, not real experience. Establish a habit of early to rise and early to rest. Maintain a light food intake. Keep everyday necessities simple, orderly and clean. Maintain a simplistic lifestyle. Don't be complicated, disorganized, filthy or opulent. Avoid distractions. The pursuit of sensation. So I think there's enough there to work on. I mean, the stuff I've covered tonight, there's a fair bit of practice in there. There's a fair bit of good day-to-day advice. I thought last night Horgenstam was going to talk about Bjorkan, but he didn't. But in any event, I remember that Bjorkan, I think, was famous for writing lists. Did he write lists of things to do? Yeah, things he must do. Some of them were like go shopping, I think, but other things were like practice-related things. And so maybe you should write your own lists. And I kind of like the idea of a monastic rule that can be applied to everyday life, like the rule of St. Benedict. You know, lots of rules, but you can, in your own everyday life, you can just write a few things down that you think are really important, perhaps they've come to you while you're sitting here, things that you really think are important. It's good to write them down at the end of the retreat because they can fade. And sometimes when you write them down again, don't go back and look at it, and you go to the next retreat, and you take that piece of paper with you, why didn't I do that? Yeah. It was such a good idea, and we get, you know, the tidal wave just comes over the top, and we lose all this stuff. So write down what you think is really important to do, like maybe just one or two things to change in your daily routine to give yourself a chance. Give yourself a chance of letting the world come in. So I'm now finished. So I'll give you a little poem. I didn't write it. It's a Celtic poem, but I think it's very Buddhist, nevertheless. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life.
On the timetable. You've blown the timetable.
I'm going to lash out once, haven't I?
Everything you say.
Get back home. Of one precept. Do you remember? I don't know exactly this Zen Master Dogen word or not. Initial motivation is not genuine, if our deepest vow is not genuine, whatever we practice, is being spent in vain. Do you remember? We started from this one precept. This question, we started with this one precept. Our cleverness, intellect, can create any theory, any skyscrapers, jungles, we can build. But then, what happened? Now, global destruction. Global destruction. Because of the initial motivation with human beings was not right. No, we should clarify this. The initial motivation, the deepest vow, do you think was right? Throughout our history, human history? No. We started with our karmic desire, of course. We started. Choicelessly, maybe. But our practice and our sangha should be based on this. This is how it is. Three monkeys. We can find this. But in fact, this one precept, unless our initial motivation, deepest unconscious vow, is not right, everything we build, jungle, skyscraper, that is this cleverness, intellect, cause. That's all. Hell. Do you know hell? Do you really know? Hell is in this box. And the Zazen is took to clean this. Breath by breath. We are emptying this thing. So always we need to get back home of this one precept, initial motivation. The deepest bar. Always we need self-check. The more we need practice, the more we need to get back home. Not that we are going to someone else, not to the other shore. No, this shore. Okay, tomorrow we will have ordaining ceremony for 6 of us from Kansas. Okay.